Ele hadvarim asher diber Moshe el kol Yisrael be'ever hayarden bamidbar ba'arava mohol suf bein paran uvein ta'ofel vilavan v'chatzerot v'dizav. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. And this show is for Parshat Devarim, also known as Shabbat Chazon, the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. Recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the fourth day of Av and of August. Av and August matched up last in 1981. Before that, in 62. And before that, 1924, if I have my numbers correct. It happens. Months on the Jewish calendar and the Hebrew and the secular calendar match up roughly every 32 or 33 months. And 2.5 to 3 years it takes for them to match up. February's 28 days and sometimes 29 plays a little bit around with the neatness of the statistic. And then, of course, you have sometimes where a 30-day month in the Jewish calendar matches a 30-day month in the secular calendar, which means you'll have two in a row with the numbers matching up until the very end of the second month. And because of February, you'll sometimes have January matching, and then not February, but March matching again. It's a fun kind of trivia of the calendar, but that's not germane to today's show. Having said that, let us do Tehillim, Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, and then we'll get down to business. Shir HaMa'alot, Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai, Adonai Shima V'Koli, Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot, L'Kol Tachanunai, Im Avonot Tishmorya Adonai mi amod, ki imcha hasalicha lema'an tivare, ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi, velidvaro hocholti, nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker, yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora, umishibud lgeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Alright, let's go back in the calendar a little bit. The Mishnah, at the very end of Masechet Ta'anit, speaks of tragedies, calamities that occurred to the Jewish people on the 17th of Tammuz and on Tisha B'Av. Five tragedies for each date. That blocked out a period of time which we call Bein HaMitzarim, between the dire straits, of tragedies added on to tragedies, and that created a situation where in the Ashkenazi Jewish world, the period of the 3 weeks has a mournful nature. It goes in stages. It starts off mild, where weddings are not held and hair cutting is not permitted. All kind of different details. We don't have to get involved with other things like music. We'll leave that off for now. The period comes to the month of Av, And based on a statement in the Mishnah, Misha nichnas av mima'atim besimcha, as av enters, we diminish our joy, and a more intensive, mournful period begins, which we call the 9 days. In reality, it's 9.5 days. We'll get there in a moment. The 9 days have additional restrictions. Noteworthy is that during the week, except for Shabbat, we don't drink meat or we don't drink wine or eat meat. That has two reasons, by the way. One is a concept that a definition of joy when it comes to eating is having meat and wine, and therefore it's not appropriate for this period of mourning. The other is a more specific connection to temple service, which involved the meat of animals and wine of libation. And therefore, when the Beit HaMikdash, its destruction, is being mourned, it's sort of insensitive and not appropriate to eat meat or drink wine. I should add that from the point of view of actual essential halakha, Jewish law, meat and wine is forbidden only on the meal preceding Tisha B'Av. The extension of that to the 9 days is of developmental nature through the generations. I can't tell you exactly when people started to do that, but it became fixed in Jewish practice not to have meat or drink wine during the 9 day period, with the exception of Shabbat. The beginning part of the 9 days reaches the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. It is known as Shabbat Chazon, based on the reading of the prophets, which is the beginning of the book of Yeshayahu, Isaiah, which begins with the words Chazon Yeshayahu, the vision of Yeshayahu. So the Shabbat became known as Shabbat Chazon. Parshat Devarim, the first sedra of the book of Devarim, is always read right before Tisha B'Av, on that Shabbat, very significantly. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. On Shabbat Chazon, we do eat meat and drink wine, because Shabbat, you may not have public displays of mournful behavior. And I would add that Shabbat is also your promise for the future, your sample of the future. We refer to Shabbat as Me'ein Olam Haba, a foretaste of the world to come. If we broaden that idea as being a foretaste of Messianic era, when we will not be mourning on Tisha B'Av and during the 3 weeks, etc., then the Shabbat of today gives us a glimpse to brighter times of the future, and we eat meat and drink wine. There are still other customs and practices for Shabbat Chazon, which remind us of the fact that it is now and it's not yet the future. Right after Shabbat Chazon, you have a more intensified period of mourning known as Shavua Shechalbo, the week in which Tisha B'Av falls. That length of time will vary depending on what day of the week Tisha B'Av is. This year it's Tuesday, Monday night, Tuesday next, and therefore we're talking about Saturday night, Sunday, one day, Sunday night, Monday, which is Erev Tisha B'Av, and even the practices are stepped up a bit, and then Tuesday night, Monday night, Tuesday, which is Tisha B'Av itself, and Tuesday night until midday of Wednesday is that part of the 10th of Av where we continue the mournful practices of the 9 days. And, for example, meat and wine is not permitted until the afternoon of this coming Wednesday. And marriages would not take place before that afternoon. They usually wouldn't anyway, but that's not the point. And music and doing laundry and wearing freshly laundered garments all wait until midday following Tisha B'Av, meaning midday of the 10th of Av. The mournful practices of Tisha B'Av, of course, are the most severe and strict, and that rounds out the period. I mentioned the Ashkenazi community holding by the concept of the 3 weeks. The Sephardi community generally hold certain things from Rosh Chodesh Av, or from right after Rosh Chodesh Av, until after Tisha B'Av, and some other practices apply only for Sfaradim during the week in which Tisha B'Av falls. In fact, we Ashkenazim have a couple of things that are only in that week also. What comes to mind is a small matter, but depends how you feel about having long nails and whether you bite your nails or not. But the cutting of nails is permitted during the 3 weeks and even during the beginning of the 9 days, and is forbidden by Jewish practice only during the week in which Tisha B'Av falls. And there are exceptions to just about every rule that you could think of, but we're not going to get involved in that now. Before I go any further, I want to review my forest and trees thing. There's an expression, you can't see the trees from the forest. Maybe it's you can't see the forest from the trees. I believe it should be both. I referred to the trees as the nitty-gritty detail of Jewish halakha, Jewish law, custom, practice. The forest, in my analogy, are the concepts that are behind and underlying and supporting the details, and supported by the details. There are some Jews who don't really go for the nitty-gritty detail of halakha. Isn't it enough that I am resting on Shabbat? Don't, you're telling me I can't drive in my air-conditioned car to go to synagogue on Shabbat morning. You would rather that I walk for 15 minutes in the blazing sun and come there dripping with sweat like a shmata? So you say to that person, there are various prohibitions involved in driving in a car. And yes, that's more important not to do those things than to be comfortable and than not sweating. The concept of Tisha B'Av, of the 9 days, of the 3 weeks, of a year-round, lifelong Avelut HaChurban, mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, is a many-layered concept, some of which I will help peel off in a moment and take a look at them. And in addition to the concept, there are a myriad of little details. I alluded to some of them, I mentioned some of them, I also mentioned that there are all kind of little situations which make differences in what a halachic authority will tell you you can do or you may not do. And we don't have the time to go into that. But keep in mind that we need to see the forest, but we also must appreciate the detail of every tree, every one of its branches, every leaf that grows on it. I hope you got that analogy. Don't want to spend more time on that now. I'm going to jump now to the basic idea behind the whole thing. We've got, I would say, three different major events that include lots of little events that we are mourning in some combined way at this time of the year. And each of these three events sets an agenda for us. The first event or set of events is the experience of the new nation of Israel when they left Egypt and wandered through the wilderness. Most noteworthy on the negative side is the sin of the golden calf, which is marked on Shivasar B'Tammuz, and the sin of the spies, which is marked on Tisha B'Av. Let's focus in on that for a moment, because we're coming up to Tisha B'Av, and Shivasar B'Tammuz already was. Last week, last Shabbat, this past Shabbat, in the Torah reading of Mas'ei, we read of the command by God for us to settle and dwell in the land of Israel, and the Torah set down its boundaries, and that should have been enough to get ourselves to comply and to go from Egypt via Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, where we receive the Torah, go into Eretz Yisrael like God told us to, like He wants us to, and that would be it. Instead, our leaders, 10 out of 12 who were sent to tour out the land, came back and said, a lovely place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. And they panicked the people to the point where an entire adult population was destined never to step foot into the land of Israel, but rather to die out in a period of 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. You cried for no good reason. I will give you plenty of reason to cry, says God. You cried that your wives will be widows and your children will be orphans, and that's exactly what's going to happen by your iniquities, by your lack of faith, by your panic. That is the basis, the starting point for Tisha B'Av, and that sets an agenda. The agenda is simple. We have to shake the, I don't know what you call it, inbred attitude of the Meraglim, the spies, and we have to turn things around to be like the 2 out of the 12, Kalev ben Yefune and Yehoshua ben Nun, who heard God's words and Moshe Rabbeinu's words about Eretz Yisrael and said in front of the population, if this is what God wants, then obviously we will prevail. Just don't rebel against God. Let's go. And they were shouted down. What we have to do is not just say, woe unto us, this is what happened a long time ago. We have to say, we have to be different. And many people have begun the process of return to Eretz Yisrael and the building of Eretz Yisrael. And the goal is to get to a point where we can say to God, we no longer are like that generation and all the generations since in some way or another who would rather be other places than in Eretz Yisrael. We are establishing a Jewish homeland and life and Torah observance. That's a catch also, and that's connected to the broken tablets, in the land of Israel. I believe that every Jew who comes to live in Israel is doing a portion of repair work of that devastating sin of the spies, which gave Tisha B'Av its start as a black day on the Jewish calendar. There's more, but that's the beginning. And not just coming in Aliyah, but encouraging Aliyah, having a positive attitude towards it, and carrying it through. Another aspect is the destruction of the first temple. The first Beit HaMikdash, our sources tell us, was destroyed because we turned away from God and worshipped idols and hedged our bets by showing also a little bit of whatever you want to call it in idolatry. And even if majority of people remained true to God, they were hedging their bets with idolatry, all different kind of ways of explaining this, and murder, and sexual immorality. These are the kind of things, and disregard to Shemitah. There's a long list of that which created the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. There is more for our agenda. We have to take every single one of these things and turn it around. We have to be faithful to God. We have to observe His Torah, imbue ourselves and others with Torah values, teach it to our children, and constantly improve the religious and observance atmosphere of the Torah. That's all God wants, because that includes everything. So there's part of our agenda too. It's not just, woe unto us, look at the terrible things that happened. It's, look at the direction we are going in, and there shouldn't be a need for mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. There should be the atmosphere for its rebuilding. And then you have the second Beit HaMikdash, and various statements in our literature as to why that one was destroyed. Part of it, by the way, was that it started with so few Jews returning from Babylon to build the Beit HaMikdash and to restore Jewish life in the land of Israel, which goes back to Chet HaMeraglim again, the sin of the spies. In addition, the thing that's spoken about is called Sinat Chinam, gratuitous hatred of one Jew to another. And there is an agenda. The agenda item is reverse that. The best way to reverse it is Ahavat Chinam, gratuitous, no reason, love of fellow Jew because they are your fellow Jews. And it goes on and on from there. It's how you deal with them and how you talk to your fellow Jews and all of the above. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Devarim for Shabbat Chazon. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Devarim Shabbat Chazon. Pre-Tisha B'Av, not a very comfortable period of time for the calendar. On that note, let me mention the following. Our sources discuss a person who gets into mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash a little too deeply, to put it mildly. Picture the following. A Jew takes the mourning very seriously and says after Tisha B'Av, hey, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash yet. Mourning is not just a day or a 9-day period or a 3-week period. It's really all year round. In fact, the norm instructs us to have certain behaviors all year round that are connected to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. At every wedding, when a glass is smashed by the groom, it is Zecher L'Churban. He recites, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right arm forget its cunning, whatever that means. Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. And that somber note is added to any simcha, period of joy. There is a custom to leave a square of a wall near one's door, unfinished, unpainted, unplastered, just a raw piece of wall of a certain size, commemorating the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, as if to say, if the Beit HaMikdash is not standing, if that house of God is not standing, then my personal house is not going to be complete. So here's a person after Tisha B'Av and says, look, the month of Av is a black month on the Jewish calendar. As Av enters, we diminish in Simcha. Now it's midday of the 10th of Av, one-third of the month gone, and you're telling me that that's it? I don't feel like I could eat meat or drink wine at all. We tell that person, wrong. That is not a strict behavior. That is not praiseworthy behavior. That is ridiculous behavior and counterproductive behavior. Because part and parcel of grief and mourning, and this, by the way, goes for national mourning and also for personal mourning, part and parcel of that process is a look to the future and the concept of nechama, comfort. A mourner for a loved one needs to be comforted. A mourner of Zion also needs to be comforted. And that comfort comes in the hope and prayer and prophecy of the future, that the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and that the fast days associated with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash will become festive occasions. That light at the end of the tunnel is supposed to take away some of the black heaviness of the mourning and say, yes, we're mourning now, but we are comforted by the impending, imminent Geula, redemption. It's not easy to do, especially after this last period of exile that went on and on and on for close to 2,000 years. The argument that was given to this actual or hypothetical individual who wanted to not eat meat at all is, hey, maybe you shouldn't eat bread either, because bread was part of temple service, and without the temple, it's insensitive to eat bread. Oh, okay, good idea. And maybe you can't eat fruit either, because there were first fruits, bikurim, that were brought to the Beit HaMikdash. Good thought. I'll subsist on other things. And maybe you shouldn't even be able to drink water, because there was water of libation on the 7 days of Sukkot in the Beit HaMikdash. The answer is, that's a nonsensical thing to behave that way, and we tell the person you're doing the wrong thing. Grief and mourning must have boundaries and be contained within them. Otherwise, they become a destructive course, a destructive force. I want to now take one or two different angles to add to this mosaic of Tisha B'Av. I mentioned that in last week's Torah reading of Maaseh, we read of Eretz Yisrael, the excitement of telling the people, you're at the border, we're going to cross the Jordan River shortly, the boundaries of Israel will be from X, Y, Z, A, B, C, and you're going. Okay. In Devarim is Moshe Rabbeinu's final summing up of the Jewish nation and its destiny and its Torah and what happened over the 40 years. He starts and dwells upon that sin of the spies. It's as if he's saying to the people, you are standing here now 40 years after we came out of Egypt, because of the sin of the spies, and you have to know how that worked. And we find certain things that he says about it different from the original account in Parshat Shalach. where we see Moshe Rabbeinu sort of taking blame, or at least partial blame, upon himself for what had happened. He said, you asked, you, the people, your parents, asked to send an advanced delegation, and I thought it was a good idea. So I sent the spies. Their purpose was to determine the best strategy for how to enter the land. They were not sent in order to determine whether we should go there or not. That was a given. And that was the problem. Because when they came back, they were supposed to report on what they saw, which they did, and they were not supposed to say, but we can't go there. Because that was the given. Anyway, Moshe is talking about this, and it sets a tone on this Torah reading of the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, which sort of plugs in. You know, we think in terms of Tisha B'Av, primarily the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple, the first one and the second one. But the book of Devarim, the Sedra of Devarim, the Shabbat reading before Tisha B'Av, obviously does not talk about the Beit HaMikdash. That's from the period of the rest of Tanakh, not from the Torah portion. And there we get the angle of the sin of the spies, which I said earlier is the foundation that started Tisha B'Av in its direction. And we can't separate it out. We can't just think in terms of temple number one, temple number two. We have to think of the early years of the people. They had a Mishkan, a temporary temple, which went with them through their travels. And yet, there was... That was not problematic yet. That came later. The problem was the attitude of we'd rather stay here in the Midbar or we'd rather go to Egypt. And these are things that are said today, not about going to Egypt and not about staying in the Midbar, but about staying in very prominent Jewish communities in different parts of the world. And it's part of that same sin of the spies syndrome. Another angle here, which we need to put on the board, is other things that are associated with Tisha B'Av. For example, we have a, I don't know if it's a tradition or it's historical, provable, accurate data, I don't think it makes a difference, that the expulsion from Spain began or was decreed on Tisha B'Av. That adds a later dimension to Tisha B'Av, reinforcing its blackness as a date on the calendar, and adds to our thinking process, our introspection, our resolutions, and agenda items, as I mentioned before, of the thinking process that goes together with Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av can't be a day where, because you're fasting, after the services are over, you take a nap and you sleep off the rest of the day. It needs to be a day of pondering many, many different elements in Jewish history, which are all Tisha B'Avi, even though they are not the primary character of Tisha B'Av, they belong. Even the Holocaust. Now, the Holocaust obviously spanned a number of years, which meant it was any date on the calendar or every date on the calendar over and over again. Yet there is an association with Tisha B'Av as if we needed to focus on a specific day. Now, we do have a Holocaust Memorial Day. I don't want to get into that whole thing. But Tisha B'Av is also a Holocaust Memorial Day. In fact, the keynote of Tisha B'Av, the lamentations and elegies and eulogies, or however you say it, which are read on Tisha B'Av, mostly in the morning, include a later edition in our time of one or two keynote addressing the Holocaust. You look in the British edition of a keynote book and you will find a kina for the York massacres from 1170, I believe it was. Pogroms get in there, and various repeats in different shapes and forms of the flow of Jewish history, the negative flow of Jewish history, pile on to Tisha B'Av. The way I think about it is, if we had a calendar chart on the wall with every day of the year, and we started filling in the dates with things that happened to the Jewish community negatively, we would fill every single box. We would see that in the 14th century, in this part of Europe, such and such a thing occurred on this date. And in Spain in this year, that happened. And in the in Yemen, on this date, in that century, something else happened. And we can't live like that. You can't have an entire calendar of 353 to 385 days, which happens to be the range of the number of days of a Jewish year, or I could say 365 and a quarter days on average, where every single day is a mournful day. So our sages were wise in focusing and localizing, and they did it in this build-up fashion from a mild, mournful behavior of Shivas or B'Tammuz, intensifying in the beginning of the month of Av, intensifying further on the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, as I've already described, intensifying further still on Erev Tisha B'Av in the afternoon, and then in Tisha B'Av day itself, Tisha B'Av night, Tisha B'Av day, various prohibitions. It's a hard day. But it's a day that requires our thinking and, more importantly, our resolution to do something about it. I wrote in the lead tidbit this week, I don't know if it got across the way I wanted to, that personal mourning for a loved one, the loss of a loved one, has many parallels in its detail with the Tisha B'Av period. And we tend to match them or equate them more than they are really able to be done. Big difference is when you mourn the loss of a parent, for example, you believe in a world to come, an Olam Haba and an Olam Ha'emet, and in Tchiyat HaMeitim, the revival of the dead at some point in the future. But we don't know enough about any of that to take more than our belief and be comforted by it, that he or she went to a better place, a more significant place and time, and that's it. And we mourn their loss because we don't have them. And that comes out in a certain way. National mourning, as I've been saying the whole show, has, or should have, an agenda. You could do something about it. You don't say, woe unto us, the Second Temple was destroyed, and we are grieved, and we are sad. No, it's not enough. You have to say, I know why it was destroyed. It was destroyed because people, even people who learned Torah and lived lives of Torah, were not behaving well with each other. They were looking down their nose at people that they shouldn't have been doing. They were treating people, their fellow Jews, poorly. That's something that we can change. And unfortunately, we sometimes, more often, repeat all of the problems in the first place. But it gives us more than hope. It gives us the feeling to say, I believe if we, this generation, and by the way, every generation can say the same thing. I haven't lived in every generation. I live in this generation. As long as we are alive, we can look at ourselves and say, our predecessors did not succeed, and we are determined to become better people in every meaningful way, and more than individual, a better community, a better Jewish world. And we can get to the point, that's our goal, where God will say, enough exile, enough punishment, enough repeating the sad cycles of Jewish history. It's time, they're ready, we are ready, to move on to the next level. And the next level is the Messianic time, with the coming of Melech HaMashiach, with the building of the Beit HaMikdash, with the restoration of Torah values and practice to the Jewish people, with the restoration of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, with the understanding of all the nations in the world that the Jewish people have a special status in God's world and in His universe, and we move on to a life which physically will be the same that we are familiar with now. According to Maimonides, we're talking about people behaving, and not behaving, people living with the same kind of conditions, but there won't be wars among the nations, and that will, I'm saying this editorially, free up a tremendous amount of budget that goes to defense now, and be able to use it for curing diseases and improving the life of all the people of the world, and taking people out of poverty. And, you know, it's obviously more complicated than I'm making it seem, but it's a bright future that we face. And we can bring that future closer. There's a notion based on certain verses in the Bible that there is a time which we are not aware of, that God will not delay the coming of the Mashiach beyond. We can either wait until we get to that time, whenever it will be, in which case, if we're ready, fine, and if we're not ready, things are going to have to be rough on purging the world, or we can hasten the coming of the Mashiach. You hasten the coming of the Mashiach by doing Mashiach's work for him, starting the work, continuing the work, making it easier for him. And if, again, as Maimonides describes, the major tasks of Mashiach are restoring Torah to the Jewish people and the Jewish people to the land of Israel and the building of the Beit HaMikdash, then certainly on the first two items, we can have that on our agenda, which we do, and that means Jewish education, and that means youth groups, and that means adult seminars, in order to bring in the most pleasant way the beauties of a Torah life to all the Jewish people, especially those who have not been exposed in a positive way to Judaism, and to encourage Aliyah and facilitate absorption so that we grow into a mighty spiritual nation living a life of Torah in the land of Israel. The building of the temple, we have some impediments at the moment. We have things we can do at the moment. We have education towards the period when we will have the Beit HaMikdash. We have the Temple Institute and other places like it who are preparing vessels to be used in the temple service and training Kohanim to perform their service and raising a consciousness and an awareness among the people that this is in our future, hopefully the soon future. All of this is part of the agenda, and all of this can occupy our thoughts and our pondering on Tisha B'Av, so that right after Tisha B'Av, we're already in a different mode, and we can hopefully proceed to see some of these things come into fruition. We're just about out of time for this week's Torah Tidbits audio. I feel a need to apologize for what might be rambling or repeating too many things, but that's the nature of this period of the year. I would like to wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, since we just started the month, a meaningful Tisha B'Av in all of that, what it could mean, and a bright future, which includes the Geula Shlema, the complete redemption, b'mheira v'yameinu, soon in our time. L'hishtameah.